Good morning and welcome to Many Paths, Many Visions, brought to you by the Labyrinth Society and with your host, Christiana Brinton. In conjunction with the theme for the Labyrinth Society Annual Gathering this year, Diverse Journeys on a Common Path, Building Community Through the Labyrinth, our series for the remainder of 2016 will have a similar theme, using labyrinths to address social issues. This is our third episode, and listeners can live chat with my guest and me during the 15-minute Q&A session at the end of the interview. And for those listening live to this podcast, please do take the time to log in and chat with us. It livens up the show and provides welcome and helpful feedback. This episode is entitled, Using Labyrinths to Dissolve Boundaries Through Artistic Expression and Social Engagement. And my guest today is Reginald Adams. Good morning. He's one of the featured speakers at the Labyrinth Society gathering this year, and he's a well-known member of the Houston art scene and a committed social activist who now uses labyrinths to make a difference in young people's lives. So glad to have you on the show today, Reginald.
Oh, glad to be here, Christiana, and thank you for this opportunity to share a little bit of what we're doing here down south in Houston, Texas, with your audience.
Yeah, you have been on a few radio shows recently with Jay, too. I listened to that one. That was wonderful.
Yeah, about a week and a half ago, Jay Staley, who's one of our partners in the Labyrinth work, was able to share a little bit and a lot of what's happening with the upcoming TLS gathering with the KPFT 90.1 audience here in Houston, which reaches about 250,000 people in the Houston surrounding area. So that was great to get on air and share some of our work and let people know what's going on with the Labyrinth community here and abroad.
It was a wonderful interview and session, and I enjoyed listening to it very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So let's find out, let's get some background information about you, Reginald, for our listeners out there who maybe have never even been to Texas, let alone Houston. So can you talk about your artistic style and background and a little bit about how your art became a means of social expression for you? I mean, did one follow the other? Was chicken, you know, what was came first, a chicken or the egg thing kind of thing with you?
Very good. Well, I'll start with just, I think, my background. I think we all have encountered or run into that young child who loves to draw. And every time we see them, they have their colors or their pencils ready and are always excited about sharing their work with whether it's their family or their friends. And I was that little boy. And fortunately, I never grew up. I was fortunate enough to have some supportive folks around me that believed enough in my artwork to where I was able to turn it into a career. And so for the last 2 decades plus, I've been very honored and fortunate to have lived off of my creative work, which has now introduced me into the Labyrinth community. I think one of your questions was around my art style. My personality, if anyone's met me, they can tell really quickly that I'm somewhat of an extrovert. I don't mind being out in the front of things. I don't mind talking about my work. I don't mind sharing the things that we're doing with really anybody who's willing to listen. And I think that was also an attribute of being a kid, is I love to show off my drawings and my creative work. And I think that's just been now become a part of the way in which we work with others in the public art projects that we build around Houston and in the surrounding area. And I describe my style as very community engaged. In terms of the way we create public art, I would consider myself a public artist, though I do paintings in my studio. What satisfies me most now is creating artwork in the public domain. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is I can appreciate anyone being able to experience artwork, whereas you don't have to necessarily go to a museum or go to an art gallery to experience the work that we create. And I think that has helped expose our work to a much broader audience than what may typically be found in traditional art settings. And then the other component to my role as a public artist is actually putting the public in the public art. And what I mean by that is I have a real deep passion for working with community stakeholders, whether they be children or, you know, a child at heart, adults who believe in public art and who want to get involved in the creative process, who may not even see themselves as artists, but are appreciative of what art can bring to an environment. And so many of our projects, I'd say almost 99% of our work has that community engagement component, where we actually allow those participants to be a part of the design phase, to be a part of the production phase, and then ultimately be a part of that celebratory moment where we all come together to celebrate the accomplishments of that work coming to life. And so over the last 3 years, we have found ways to bring the Labyrinth into that same community engagement process, and it has become very much a cornerstone of the creative work that I'm doing now, where I'm finding avenues to not only combine my public art aesthetic, which comes in the form of murals and mosaics and sculpture, but also combining that with the labyrinths that we've been building, not only here in Houston, but around the world.
Wow, I've got so many questions. So mosaics, murals, and sculpture. So what's the medium that you use? Do you use clay, stone? What do you use for your murals? What do you use for your mosaics, first of all?
I think first and foremost, my medium of choice, Christiana, is people. it sounds kind of strange, but before we can even get into a material, we need to have the right folks around the table. And I really believe in giving the giving voice to oftentimes the overlooked and unheard voices in our communities, which tend to be the children. It tends to be the more vulnerable sectors of our society. And so we start there. So my medium is getting the right people around the table to have that conversation about what the work should reflect, what values should the work portray, what are the themes that are going to be important and relevant to that community. And then we get into the materials. And that is purely defined based on the canvas. Whether we're working outdoors in a park, or we have a wall at a school or a community center, or there's an open green space that we have an opportunity to transform, that will then dictate what type of material we'll use and manifesting these ideas and visions into something concrete and tangible in the form of some kind of public art project.
Okay. So here you are, you're a studio artist, and you say you have a studio.
Yes.
And you go from this very, very isolated, it can be isolated, you can be there for hours at a time working alone in your studio on your own art. How did you go from that into, because you kept saying we, so I'm envisioning people in your studio working yep. with you together. How did you go from that single person to the we? What was there a specific incident that happened, or was it just a gradual thing?
I really think it's always been a we factor for me. I think one aspect of being an extrovert is I enjoy being around people. Others, I'm fed off the energy of other people. And that's always been a part of my personality. It wasn't until I became an adult that I realized how to leverage that into my creative work. So I did spend a lot of isolated hours in my studio when I was building my career, you know, over two decades ago, trying to create paintings and commissioned work that would help me basically pay the bills and survive as an artist. And I didn't enjoy that. Though I enjoyed creating, I didn't enjoy creating alone. I always felt that there was something missing when I didn't have a certain type of interaction. And even if it was just a matter of creating around other people, even if it wasn't so much other people were a part of my creativity or creative process, I just like being in a room with other artists or other creatives. Somehow, some way, I'm fed off of that creative energy that's in that space. And so it was the very first large mural commission that I received here in Houston, where I was afforded a chance to work with a group of students. There are some very young children, primarily elementary school age kids. And I just fell in love with the whole process. It was the first time I'd ever worked with a group of children like this. They loved the opportunity to create this larger than life mural. I loved the laughter and the fun and the giggles and all of the joy that children bring to that kind of creative space. And I think that was really the tipping point for me, realizing that that project was going to be the cornerstone for the future of my work. And since then, any opportunity that I get, I've tried to engage community members in that creative process. And I think now my work has become renowned for that. Whereas when groups are looking for an artist that is open and comfortable and actually excited about working with others, our name tends to rise to the top of that list because we've done it so well for so many years now.
So you have to sort of get the own personal ego out of the way and and just go with it and see what blossoms out of this group of people that come together for specific purposes, for a mural for a school or whatever yes. It might be.
Yeah, that ego part is really big because I think as just humans, we're ego driven, and I think even as artists, our egos tend to get in the way of our best work because, you know, it's my idea and that, you know, I created that. And that's fine because I think we should, you know, pay homage to the source from whence things come. But working in a collective process or working with others in the creative process, it does require a certain amount of egoless, if that's such a word, approach. Because you are allowing others to have influence on the final outcome. Now, I will say that there's usually an idea that I may have before I even start the project. Maybe I've seen it in a dream. Maybe I've seen it in a vision. Maybe it's something that I've heard around this community or this group that's kind of inspired some initial ideas. But what I tend to do is refrain from putting forward my idea first until I hear the ideas of the community. And then I'm able to extrapolate the essence of what the community wants to see or what they feel is important. And then I'm able to kind of weave their ideas into my idea. And so at the end of the day, my vision is still there, but they also see a reflection of themselves through their own ideas. And I think that's what makes a really strong community project is when the people who are part of it, whether they drew it out or whether they painted it out or whether they helped make it, no matter what stage of the process they may have been involved in, they see a reflection of themselves. And I think that's, to me, a mark of a truly successful community-based art project.
Mm. Fabulous. So let's get back to the labyrinth entering your life. Did you, when you, was this a picture that you saw first? Was it somebody talking and saying, hey, we have a labyrinth we want made or something. Can you be a part of this? Or, I mean, because labyrinths aren't necessarily, there's a lot of way to use them. So connecting them to your art and your social activism, was that an automatic thing for you or? Was it?
No, actually I want to say that it was a happy surprise through a really dynamic public art project, for lack of better words. I was introduced through the labyrinth. A friend of mine, Mike Party, was a co-partner on a program called the Sacred Sites Quest. And for years, we would recruit high school students from around the Houston area to visit sacred spaces in and around Houston. And these sacred spaces would include churches and synagogues and temples, mosques, cathedrals, prayer gardens, and a labyrinth. There was a labyrinth, a really beautiful labyrinth at one of the local universities here in Houston. And that labyrinth visit was a part of our tour for about 4 years. But it wasn't until the fifth year where we actually decided to build a labyrinth that the labyrinth actually began to affect my creative work. So I had walked labyrinths for years prior, but I never really had a profound epiphany or eureka moment just in walking the labyrinth. But in 2014, I ended up meeting a guy named Jay Staley, who's become a really great friend and has been really my primary labyrinth building partner over the last 3 years. And in June of 2014, we dedicated a labyrinth that we constructed with a group of high school kids through the Sacred Sites Quest in one of Houston's oldest African-American communities, also known as the Fourth Ward or Freedmanstown. And it was that entire process of learning about the history of the labyrinth, learning about how to design a labyrinth, and then ultimately building one in this historic community that solidified the labyrinth as a key cornerstone to my creative portfolio. And I owe a lot to Jay because he just opened my eyes up to the power of the path and how the labyrinth has been used for thousands of years around the world as this meditational tool for reflection. And it was after the construction of the labyrinth that Jay would host these monthly full moon labyrinth walks. And it was month after month that I would go and walk, either walk myself or just go as a casual observer. And I would talk to people after the labyrinth walk and get their feedback. Some of them, I would let them know that I was a part of this particular labyrinth build, but then others, I would just, you know, ask them, how did they feel after they finished walking the labyrinth? And it was time and time and time again, people would say how the labyrinth changed their life. And that was really a pivotal moment for me because prior to constructing that labyrinth, I had been involved in literally hundreds of public art projects, murals and sculptures all over Houston and all over the world. And we've gotten a lot of great accolades and notoriety and media coverage and a lot of great thanks. And we love the work and it's beautiful. But no one's ever told me that one of our public art projects had changed their life. And it was that labyrinth that I heard that over and over again. It made me realize that as a creator and as a spiritual being here on earth, I wanted to create things that would change people's lives on a spiritual level. And so over the last 2.5 years, I've really dedicated much of my creative work to now building labyrinths and also sharing the power of the labyrinth with the next generation, and that's our youth, because I feel like they will be they will need to take on the understanding of the power of this work so that they can then share it with their community and ultimately their children and their families.
That's very powerful, Reginald. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. Now let's talk about this youth thing. We at the Labyrinth Society, we know that it makes a difference with young people. We know it makes a difference in schools. There are labyrinths in schools, private schools, universities all over. They've been used for a long time to help people, you know, the kids help with their right and left brain synchronicity and getting that in alignment and helping them focus and stay calm. And so it helps them with testing. But what you do is very different, and getting young people involved in a community way, in a way that makes a difference within their communities, is a big deal. It's not easy to do. Kids are isolated. They have their technology. They have their stuff that they do. That's, you know, very narrow focused. So why did you focus on the high school age youth, and what were the avenues available to you to make this happen in the Houston area?
So the focus on youth in general, I think, has just been a part of what motivates me artistically. I didn't necessarily have professional artists in my life growing up. So even though I knew I wanted to be an artist, I didn't necessarily know exactly what it took to be an artist or what it looked like to become an artist. And so one of the commitments that I made earlier in my art career was to share my journey and my path with young people, because I meet so many young kids who have creative talent, but they don't necessarily have people around them who help celebrate that creativity. So like many things, if we don't use it, we tend to lose it. And I run into so many adults who say, oh, when I was a child, I used to draw, or I used to paint, or I used to sing, or I used to dance, or I used to design, or whatever it is. And because of life circumstances, they got away from that creative outlet. And so I've tried to make a point in my work to reach that generation and empower them with the idea that if they want to be a creative, there's nothing stopping them other than themselves. And so the children have always been a focal point in my work. I mean, most people who know me, they know, hey, that's the guy who works with the kids. And I celebrate that. So it was easy to make the transition from involving students in public art to involving students in the labyrinth work. It just became, I was using now a different tool. So rather than teaching them how to paint or teaching them how to draw or teaching them how to design, now we're teaching them how to use other materials to create these ancient archetypes. And so why high school kids become so important to me is I have a high school age son who's 15. He's currently a sophomore, and I'm watching real time the challenges that he's confronting as he kind of navigates through life from becoming a young man, a tween, an adolescent, to becoming a young man. And I watch how technology has pretty much consumed his generation. I watch how media has kind of overwhelmed them with information coming from all different avenues, which makes it difficult for them to discern what's true and what's real and what's significant and what's important. And so he's become somewhat of a test pilot, a guinea pig, if you may, for me to test out the impact that the labyrinth has on these young people. And one thing that I found that we've discovered in working with young people, primarily teenagers, and the labyrinth, is that while on the labyrinth, that's one time that these kids are unplugged. It's whether it's a 30-minute walk or a 15-minute walk or a 10-minute walk, without even asking, these young folks know that that is a sacred time and space to put their phones away, put them in their pockets, do without the selfies, and plug into whatever's going on internally that will allow them to hear their inner voice and receive what the labyrinth has to share with them. And so as simple as that may sound, it becomes very important in a media-rich world with 24-hour media cycles, and giving those young people that small period of time to meditate, to reflect, to pray, to be still, to be silent, in the midst of all of this chaos and outside noise and interference that they deal with every day. And so that's become one of the main drivers, is to give them that solace, that peace of mind, and know that whether it's a labyrinth they go walk in a park or in a community center, or whether it's a labyrinth that they download off the internet and can walk with their finger, they have within their own control the time to take and give themselves that peace of mind that we all need in this chaotic world that we're living in.
So you talked about your son, but you have actually created and funded and completed two summer programs that have brought these kids, a certain group of high school students, to other countries to build labyrinths. So let's talk about this summer program and how it went from, you know, having kids just walk a labyrinth, as you were just talking about, to an actual program that has changed their lives probably, as well as the recipients of the labyrinths too.
Yes. Okay. So I alluded to this project a few minutes ago, the Sacred Sites Quest. And it started in 2009. We began taking these students around Houston, visiting these sacred spaces, walking the labyrinth. In 2014, we built a labyrinth. And it was that year, after constructing the Freedmanstown Labyrinth, that we decided it was time to go international with this concept of visiting and creating sacred spaces. This dovetailed well with a passion of mine for traveling. I've been very fortunate to have traveled all over the world. I've been to close to 30 countries, studying public art and really embracing the culture of communities around the world, which I try to bring back to the work that we do here in Houston. And so from having been so touched myself by the power of travel, we decided that we would take on a very ambitious goal, and that was raise enough money to fund 15 high school kids and our team of 10 adult leaders to visit France and visit sacred spaces in and around northern France, in and around Paris. We ended up visiting Chartres. We didn't get a chance to walk the well-known labyrinth in Chartres, but we had a chance to see it. And then ultimately that trip landed us in Lyon, where we were able to build a labyrinth directly adjacent to the Basilica de Fauvier, which is at the highest point of the city. So if you are familiar with Lyon, there's essentially a small mountain in the heart of the city, which overlooks the historic part of Lyon. And at the tip top of that mountain is a beautiful 1,000-year-old cathedral. And we were afforded the opportunity to build a labyrinth directly next to this gorgeous sacred space, which is also a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And so throughout that entire 10-day journey, the process of building the labyrinth, the infusion of culture, the excitement of having to construct this with the folks there on the ground, it was life-changing, I think, for everybody on that trip. And that program was successful enough to attract additional funding to where we were able to take 18 high school students this past summer to Ecuador for a 10-day adventure, visiting sacred spaces in and around Quito, Cuenca, Guayaquil, and ultimately building a labyrinth in Riobamba, which is a river tributary off of the Amazon. So here we are in the rainforest at an incredibly beautiful retreat center, constructing a labyrinth using river rocks directly on the equator. And words can't describe how beautiful the environment was, but even more importantly, how beautiful the transformations we saw in these young people, giving them a chance to leave a legacy in these countries and also embrace the cultures of these ancient societies and come back to Houston and share these stories with their friends and their families has just been, it's been everything for me. And it's driving my passion to continue creating these opportunities for travel and connectivity with the labyrinth with these young folks here in Houston.
Wow. Okay. That's a big deal to try to make that happen. On so many levels, it's a big deal. Can you tell us a little some of the obstacles you face creating and implementing these trips? I mean, besides the language barrier, where did you go to even find some place who was interested in doing this with you? And
that's a great question. Yeah, that's a great question. The bigger challenges are the logistics. You know, we're not just telling kids, hey, show up on, you know, July 1st and we're going to be flying off to this foreign country. The program takes over 9 months to get the young people prepared for travel. And so logistically, we're thinking month by month, what type of information, what type of experiences, what type of team building activities do we need to implement into this 9 month transitional period to get these kids ready for 10 days of very intense travel abroad. These kids are not traveling with their parents, so this is a unique experience for them to be away from home. A lot of these kids have not traveled internationally before, so those are challenges that we have to confront. Getting the kids comfortable with each other. They're 18 high school kids coming from 18 different high schools. So it's not like they are kids who see each other all the time. So they're close friends and they know each other. They see each other typically once a month. So within that 9 month period prior to departure, one of our key objectives is to build a family unit so that when we are abroad, the kids feel very close to each other, close enough to where if anything goes wrong, everyone knows what to do. Everyone knows who the right points of contact are. It's getting them familiar with the transition in language. So we do have some language study classes that take place. We try to expose them to the religions and to the politics of those countries prior to departure. We actually build a labyrinth here in Houston to give them experience with the labyrinth design prior to departure. And then we talk about all the logistics of moving 30 people around a foreign country by plane, train, boat, and automobile. And then that becomes a whole logistical challenge of making sure folks are in the right place at the right time. Of course, safety is priority one. Communicating back with families, letting everyone know that their kids are safe, making sure that all the dietary needs are being met with 30 different people, with 30 different, you know, dietary interests, making sure there's room and board and accommodations, and that the transportation is there, and that the tickets are bought, and excursions to different places that we want to go are covered and taken care of. And so this SSQ experience has really helped me just refine my facilitation skills. It's helped me refine my planning and organizing skills, because when you can do that on that level with 30 people in foreign country, it makes it a lot easier to do those same types of activities on a local level with even fewer people. And so I'd say it's probably become one of my best learning lessons personally. And then I get a chance to work with an incredible team of adults who bring their own skill sets and talents, which only help and strengthen and enrich the experience that the young people have, because they're able to learn from all of these adults, and in turn, we're able to learn from them and then leave a legacy in these foreign countries as a byproduct of the entire experience.
So, okay. So do you have, I mean, so I get that's great. And it's an amazing process and an amazing machine that you've created here to make this all happen. But who decides where to go? I mean, who picked France and Ecuador? I mean, how do you even get contacts with these countries? I mean, where do you start? Are these a couple of adults on your team who do this initial reaching out and connecting?
Yes and no. So France came about in 2012. I had received a commission to create a mosaic sculpture in Lyon. And so coming back from Lyon, I always had an idea in my mind that I would go back. It's a beautiful city. It's a gorgeous, ancient, historic city in the southern central part of France. And so I always knew that I was going to go back. I just didn't know under what circumstances. So while I was in Lyon, because I was there for such a relatively long period of time, I was able to establish some really great connections, people that would support the return regardless of what we were going to return for. So when the idea to take SSQ or the Sacred Sites Quest International started to gain traction, Lyon became an easy target because I knew I had relationships there. And there were some serendipitous events that occurred after we decided on Lyon, because one of the key donors for the sponsoring of Lyon, of the SSQ Lyon, was a French-based company. So they were excited that we had chosen a French or that we had chosen France for our initial SSQ, because they had a prior relationship with France. And then that parlayed into a partnership with the Texan French Alliance for the Arts, which I had a pre-existing relationship with. So it was those connections that made France an easy target. And then it was through, I think it's just a series of some crucial conversations that we were able to identify the location, and that almost fell in our laps. I sent a request out to my colleagues in Lyon for a venue. We were thinking about a public park, And one thing led to another. We ended up getting connected to the director of academic services for the ECAM Lyon, which is the Graduate School of Design for the city of Lyon. And they said, hey, we have this land at the top of the hill. We just bought this property from the church or from the cathedral, and we'd be delighted for you all to build your labyrinth on this property. And unbeknownst to us, we were being given a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And I think had we have asked for it, we would have probably been told, hell no. You know, we're not going to let some American kids on top of that build a labyrinth on this sacred space. But I think they understood the power of this partnership, and they had a lot of respect for this French company that was sponsoring us. So I think there was a lot of credibility that was built around what we were bringing to the table that opened up that doorway and ultimately yielded this incredible labyrinth in this really special sacred space in Lyon. And then it was all of the work, the photographs, the video, the testimonies that came out of the Sacred Site Quest Lyon that opened up an opportunity for Ecuador. So Jay Staley, my colleague, had already had some contacts in Ecuador, and he had began talking to a retreat facilitator about building a labyrinth on her space. And we didn't know how it was going to happen. We didn't know when it was going to happen. And she didn't have necessarily the funding, but we knew that there was a connection in Ecuador. And so about three quarters into our trip to France, our donor contacted us and said, hey, I love what we're seeing with the work that you all are doing with the students in France. How about you all think about 2016 and consider going to Ecuador? We have a partner down there that we'd love for you all to work with. And when Jay and I heard the news, we were like, Ecuador? You know, wow, that's great. And, you know, so again, it was a series of fortuitous events that allowed us to go into this next country almost effortlessly. Our donor, which is Schlumberger, they had been doing a lot of work with STEM and a high school there in Quito. It was a perfect match for us because we love working with high school kids. And because Quito was just only 2 hours away from this retreat center that initially requested this labyrinth, it was an easy destination to put on the itinerary. So we just started planning out what that needed to look like. And lo and behold, we had a location that had basically been donated to us. We had a donor that wanted us in Quito, and we had a great, beautiful location to bring these students to. So all of these two past locations really came effortlessly, and the same has now come for our third destination, which is South Africa. And we've already established the partner. We have a partner high school in Johannesburg. We have some relationships there that have already been pre-existing, and now it's just getting the kids ready and getting the funding in place and basically putting the machine back in order so that we can do this again next summer, 2017 SSQ South Africa.
Wow. Wow. It's so inspiring, Reginald. It's really makes me choked up. Gets me choked up. It's so inspiring.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Christiane.
So do these labyrinths, so I just want to know, I know there's pictures on the website, but for people who haven't tuned into your website and Sacred Sites Quest, is there a name to the labyrinth in Lyon, and what is the labyrinth design? What type of labyrinth did you install there, and what about the one in Keep in Ecuador too?
Yes, so anyone who's interested in seeing the work that I'm describing, they can visit us online, really easy. It's www.reginaldadams.com. And one of our navigation buttons is to labyrinths. And there you'll find examples of the labyrinths that we've designed and built here in Houston, as well as the two labyrinths that I've spoken of in Lyon and in Ecuador. And so the labyrinth in Lyon is it's 42 feet in diameter. It's a classical design. It's a five circuit. In fact, it's the actual pattern that's on this T-shirt. This is the commemorative shirt that was created. So we left a legacy in Lyon. And so this is the pattern that was used. And we created the labyrinth using pavers that were then embedded or entrenched into a turf landscape. And so the labyrinth in Ecuador, we used a Native American design called the Man in the Maze. And it's actually in a nine-circuit labyrinth. It was 50 feet in diameter, and we created that labyrinth using river rocks from the Riobamba River, which was just about a quarter of a mile away from the retreat center. And this is the labyrinth that we built along the equator.
Wow. So these are both open to the public? Anybody can walk them if they're there anytime?
The labyrinth in Lyon requires an appointment. It's on the grounds of the universities, but they're very open to allowing anyone who wants to walk it. In fact, one of our colleagues, Tracy Keeling, who I met here in Houston during our labyrinth facilitator training, she was in France this summer, and I get a email in the middle of the night, and so that, you know, they're 8 hours ahead of us. And she's saying, "Hey, Reggie, I'm in Lyon. I just made a quick trip down here, and I'd love to walk you all's labyrinth, and I'd love to get access." And so just through a series of quick text messages, she was able to gain access into the space and was able to walk the labyrinth, and she sent pictures. Mm-hmm. And so to your question, yes, it's a private space, but it's open to the public by appointment. And if anybody's interested, they can go online. Actually, the Worldwide Labyrinth Locator has information about that labyrinth. And if anybody wants more details, they can, of course, contact me via my website, which again is reginaldadams.com. And then the labyrinth in Ecuador, it's on the property of a retreat facility. And so it's a relatively rural environment. It's in the rainforest, so you'd kind of have to know where you're going and really want to, you know, find this location in order to get there. But I would encourage anyone to call El Encanto, which is the name of the retreat space, before getting out there to make sure that they're on the grounds and that there's not others there already, you know, utilizing their space, because they do utilize their center for ongoing facilitations of various spiritual retreats.
Okay, so that's El Encanto, E-L, then E-N-C-A-N-T-O?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. And that's in Riobamba, Ecuador.
That just amazing stories. And so you said next year it's South Africa, Johannesburg?
Yes, we'll go to Johannesburg in July of next year, and we're going to India in December for the winter break. We're actually going to conduct two student-based SSQs next year, and we have our first adult SSQ, and that'll be to Northern Ireland, where we'll be building a labyrinth there in the northern part of Ireland, and that'll be in August of 2017.
Oh, wow. And now, how do you pick the kids? How do the kids get picked for this?
That's a great question. The kids really pick themselves. The program, SSQ, is voluntary, so the students have to want to be involved. And because it is such an intense, culturally rich experience, it attracts a certain type of student. And so we've really not had to do a lot of work in finding the kids. It's really a matter of kids being ready to travel, being ready to commit to the 9-month pre-trip activities, and then ultimately committing to be away from home for those 10 days. And so when you start talking about all of what goes into one of our sacred sites quest, it's very appealing to young people who want to make a difference. It's appealing to young people who like to travel. It's appealing to young people who want to be around various career fields and being introduced to these science, technology, engineering, math, and art-based concepts. So we don't really have a problem finding the students. It's a matter of finding students who are willing to commit to such an intensive pre-trip experience and then ultimately the trip itself. And so once the kids go, they tell their friends. I mean, our best advertisement has been word of mouth. And so we really haven't had any challenges finding the kids in as much as just getting all the logistics around the trip together to make the trips actually happen.
Do you have a waiting list or is there a that kind of thing or that you haven't
figured? We do. We have parents that, you know, I think it's interesting. We have a lot of parents who are watching us via social media and or who we meet. And they want their child to be involved, but the child may not necessarily want to be involved. So we have a lot of people who say, yeah, I want my kids to go. But again, the process ends up filtering out the kids who are there because their parents want them to be there or the kids who want to be there on their own accord. And so even within that waiting list, we somehow, some way, we end up getting the right number of kids who we need to travel. And 20 is kind of our benchmark. So once we get to that number of 20, we pretty much will cut off any additional enrollments. And then those kids get rolled over and having first right of refusal for the upcoming year. And then, of course, they have to go through the same process before they're ready to travel during the summertime.
And do they have to shoulder any of the financial demands themselves or their parents or is this all grants or
no, this is we do require that the students have a buy-in. I just feel like the value is such to where everyone should have some skin in the game. So the last 2 years we have well, the first year we requested $500 as the buy-in, and this year it was a $600 buy-in because the trip costs a little more. And so the South African trip, there will be a similar buy-in. And it really just gives the kids a chance to earn their place on the trip, even if we can find sponsorship or underwriting to cover the bulk of the expenses. We still feel it's important for those young folks to know that they've put something into the coffers by buying in and having some of their own vested interests in the process.
And do they have the 9 months to pay for this, or do they have to, it's up front?
The buy-in has to take place usually before the end of the year, which is when we start dealing with the deposits and booking travel accommodations. And so their deposit basically triggers their commitment. And that really also lets us know who's vested in being a part of it, because if you don't make that deposit, though you can participate in the 9 month workshops leading up to the trip, you're unable to travel. So we do have kids who are like, hey, I want to come and be a part of the local work. I want to be involved in the STEM activities. I'd like to be involved in the studio artwork. I'd like to be involved in the community labyrinth bills, but I don't want to travel or I can't travel. And so it still gives kids who aren't necessarily travel ready a chance to be involved in what we're doing locally. But for those who are committed to the travel, by the end of the year, they have a buy-in commitment, which comes in the form of the deposit that secures their place on the actual trip itself.
Well, it sounds to me, Reginald, that they're learning a heck of a lot more than just how to build labyrinths and how to be with different cultures socially. I mean, it's amazing what you're doing. The impact I can't even imagine. And perhaps you can speak to this. You're going to be moderating, hosting a student panel discussion on Saturday, November 12th at the gathering, at the Labyrinth Society gathering.
And yeah, actually my colleague Jay Staley is going to be moderating that panel.
Okay.
But we're working close in hand with some of the questions and, of course, recruiting the kids because they'll be coming from our SSQ Quester team.
Yeah. And so we're going to hear from the students themselves how the SSQ program has affected them, how Walking Labyrinths how it's impacted their lives, what way it's impacted their lives. So, you know, this is very special for because, you know, we've seen, I know personally, I've seen lots of kids on Labyrinths, and in that moment they are they get it. Often I've seen kids race around and then sit quietly in the center for 20, 30, 40 minutes, just quietly talking or just quietly sitting there. But to talk to these young people who have been through this program, and this is rigorous. I mean, I think you really have covered, the soup to nuts, every aspect of it so thoroughly and with such creativity. I'm really so impressed. So it's really going to be exciting to hear from them how they and how it's what kind of impact it's made in their lives. But can you share, for those of us who won't be at the gathering, can you share some of this before and after examples? I mean, from you take a kid who's never been out of Texas, maybe even, and what he's like before and what he's like after this program and after being.
Well, so I'll use one example. Eliza Pillsbury, she's a sophomore in high school now, very graceful, creative young lady, has a passion for theatrics and literature. So she had never traveled internationally before. And her mother had met Jay and I on one of our labyrinth walks here in Houston. And so when the opportunity for SSQ France came online, Eliza had always dreamed of going to Paris. And so we had a student who had dropped out at the last minute, and we needed to fill that space with a student who we felt would be mature enough and ready to kind of just get plugged in. And Eliza was that student. And so when Eliza got back from France, so of course she was infused with all the culture of France. She fell in love with having been in Paris for the very first time and hearing the language and tasting the foods and the sights and the sounds. When she got back from France, she was so empowered from that entire experience that she applied to TED Talks. She submitted a proposal to TED Talks to talk about the power of the labyrinth from a teenager's perspective. And she ended up, they approved her submission. And so she ended up doing a TED Talk. And so to some people that may not be, so what, but to be 15 years old, to have a TED Talk on your resume is extremely powerful. Mm-hmm. And for her to articulate, how to walk the labyrinth and what you get from walking a labyrinth and the difference between a maze and a labyrinth was just remarkable. And she's now become one of our team leaders. We invite Eliza back to talk to other students because she's become such a great ambassador for the work itself. And she brings me to Francesca Ferris, who's now a sophomore, a freshman in college, but she's been working with SSQ for almost 4 years. So she was involved in our very first labyrinth, the one in Freedmanstown. She traveled to France with us. She joined us in Ecuador. But it was after her return from the SSQ France that she designed a summer program for a neighborhood community center where she initially just offered to work with their kids to build a labyrinth. But she was so passionate and enthusiastic about her little segment that they ended up designing the entire summer program around the labyrinth. So while she worked with these young kids and plotting out the design and what materials they would use to construct it, one of the art instructors at the summer program worked with the kids to mosaic stepping stones, which were then incorporated into the labyrinth. The mariachi band ended up writing an original score, which was then performed at the dedication of the labyrinth. The dance troupe that was developing choreography with the kids ended up creating a special dance that was then performed at the dedication of the labyrinth. So at the day of this dedication, you have all of these children, all of their family members, the board members and the staff of this community center, and of course all of the families and friends of SSQ there, watching this teenager basically share with this entire neighborhood, this labyrinth, and all of these derivative benefits and skills and talents that were birthed from this one idea. And this all came from a young lady who was part of this SSQ. So, you know, how that will change her life in the future, that's to be seen. But I know that she wouldn't have been involved in the labyrinth at that depth had it not been for this SSQ work. And I could spend the next 3 or 4 hours going down the whole list of these kids, sharing how I've seen them transform and mature and become more introspective and more tolerant. And nothing excites me more than when I get a message from one of these kids where they have taken a selfie at a labyrinth site that they have sought out on their own, which lets me know that they get it. It's not that they're only walking labyrinths when they're with us. They're walking labyrinths because they understand the power of it. And that lets me know that they're going to take this work into the future, and they'll be the ambassadors of the future of labyrinth building and design, which gives me a lot of comfort that this work is only going to continue growing.
Wow. So the whole characteristics of this archetypal tool are just so evident in this interview with you today. It's the synchronicity of how these things came about with you and Jay and the different places that you took these kids and the community building and the difference that it makes with these kids and that it makes in their communities. That is, you know, you go inward and you release and you come and you listen in the center, and then you, what can you do in your community? How can you bring this out into your community as you exit? Is so evident in what you've been talking about. It's just all right there. It's amazing. It's just really powerful. Really powerful.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been such a blessing and an honor to be able to do this work, Christiana, and to have outlets like this podcast and the Labyrinth Society as an advocate for the work. I mean, had it not been for TLS, I wouldn't be nearly as aware and informed of the significance of labyrinth work around the world as I have been. So we are growing from the work that TLS is doing, and in turn, we're using young people or we're sharing this information with these young people so that they can become future ambassadors, and they at some point will take our positions in helping communicate the significance of this work to a broader audience.
So now I'm almost afraid to ask, because you are so creative. Where do you? I understand that this is one aspect of it, that you're preparing these kids to take over and be ambassadors themselves. But how about envisioning other uses for labyrinths or art installations in other venues? Do you have plans for that or ideas for that for the future?
Oh yes, oh absolutely. I just had a really dynamic meeting yesterday with the Rice University Math Project. Rice University is a tier one world-class university here in Houston. They have an award-winning math department, and we met yesterday specifically to talk about how to use the labyrinth to teach math in early childhood education and make it culturally relevant. And they're looking at building curriculum to basically train the trainer. One of the things that their department does is train math teachers K through 12 so that math teachers have stronger tools in reaching kids, particularly within the inner city. And they've been kind of watching what's been going on with our SSQ work and have agreed to utilize the labyrinth now as a focal point in how they're teaching math. And so where that goes, no one will know until we do it, but I'm very excited about the potential in that partnership. We've recently been talking with the Houston Grand Opera about how to utilize the labyrinth in some of their community outreach. So it's a very early conversation, but here we have one of the most world-respected operas in the country here in Houston, looking at the Labyrinth as a tool to reach new audiences, and we would be at the cornerstone of that work. So here now we're combining music and the Labyrinth. We're combining math and the Labyrinth. We're combining travel in the Labyrinth as we look at new destinations for SSQ. I think, you know, because of our creative approach, we're not leaving any stones unturned in terms of how the Labyrinth can be integrated into various segments of our society. In fact, we're even building an edible garden labyrinth with a local high school in Houston that's part of their culinary arts program, where the herbs and the vegetables that will come out of this garden labyrinth will be actually cooked and prepared in this culinary program and then shared with the school community and the community at large. And so, you know, I'm excited about all of these possibilities, and I think we'll continue to push the envelope as to how we can use the labyrinth and all facets of our society.
Well, Reginald, the Labyrinth Society has been great, benefited tremendously by knowing about you and connecting with you and finding out about what Houston is doing. And we're so excited to have the gathering there this year and share your town, your city with us. I can't wait to go on that labyrinth tour. I'm just so excited. I can't wait to see it. I live right in Dallas, but I haven't even been to Houston before. So this is very exciting. Yeah, I know, silly, but it's just been a really good partnership, and we're all very excited about being there. It doesn't look like there's any questions. Look, everybody's too just listening to and soaking in the information, I think, Reginald. But we've been on quite a while, and I think that I think we're pretty much done. I just would hope that people who live in the Houston area go to the Labyrinth Society website, www.labyrinthsociety.org, and click on Gathering. There are student discounts, registration discounts. There's a day fee for if you want to just come for the day. There's also open to the public aspects to the gathering. There's an opening ceremony with a special dance troupe that Reginald and his team have invited to come, CORE dance troupe. That's open to the public. There's a veterans walk that's open to the public. And the closing ceremony is also open to the public. So if you live in the Houston area, please, or in, you know, anywhere from Austin, San Antonio, anywhere around there, please come and spend some time walking the labyrinth. There'll be temporary labyrinths on the ground. There's also the beautiful St. Paul's Labyrinth that will be utilized. So please give yourself the gift of sharing Reginald's city with him and the wonderful team, the local team that has been so invaluable in spreading the word about this gathering. And come and join us in November 10th to the 12th this year. And take a little time for yourselves and come and join us. And Reginald, it's really been such a pleasure sharing this hour with you. And, you know, I knew about all of this, what you were doing, but I hadn't really had a chance to really sit down and ask you these kind of specific questions. So it's been wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, I really do appreciate the opportunity to share what we're doing with this audience, Christiana. And I thank TLS for their support. And especially in bringing the 18th annual gathering to Houston, where those participants are going to have an opportunity to visit over 20 labyrinths that we have in the Houston area. So we look forward to sharing our labyrinth work with the community at large, and we look forward to seeing you in November. And until then, thank you for the great work that you're doing helping spread the word about the labyrinth.
Okay, you're very welcome, Reginald, and you have a wonderful, blessed day, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks again, Christiana.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Labyrinth Society's Many Paths, Many Visions, broadcast by Spreaker, with your host, Christiana Britton. Be sure to check the TLS website, Labyrinth Society website, www.labyrinthsociety.org, our Facebook page, our global group, our YouTube channel, and Google Plus for a list of upcoming dates and guests. For more information, please go to www.labyrinthsociety.org. Ciao, namaste, and may you find what you need on your path through life.